Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Meta Ideological Politics Podcast. Today, we're joined by Samuel Ludford. Some of our audience may know Sam from his piece Against Metamodernism, which is against metamodernism. That piece was referenced in last year's compendium of metamodernism, edited by Jonathan Rowson and our friend Layman Pascal, called Dispatches from a Time Between Worlds. I agree with all of Sam's critiques there and thought his take was a breath of fresh air. So I set about reading everything he writes. He writes about technology, subculture, and philosophy. He likes Jean Baudrillard, but is, as he says, a cursed analytic at heart. Yes, he quotes Hegel and Zizek and Badiou, but the analytic spirit abides in his attitude toward fancy. Wittgenstein, a hater of fancy, nevertheless considered Kierkegaard very fanciful to be the most profound author of the 19th century. And something like that seems to be going on here. The undercurrent in every case is moral, a brutal seriousness, a pragmatism, and a commitment to plain honesty that Sam's writing invariably possesses. We're privileged to have Sam's voice in the liminal mix, and we're honored to have him here to talk with us today about structure, agency, collective action, communication structures, and what ultimately to do about the meta crisis. Thanks for being here, Sam.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And thanks for the intro.
Yeah, of course. Just to get into who you are personally, I think you wrote that article last year and you came out of the blue and people read that article. So it made a little bit of a whirlwind in the liminal scene in certain sectors, I think. People were talking about it. And I think the thought was like, who is this guy? Where's he coming from? So who are you, Sam?
It's true that like I just kind of have tried to keep a low profile generally, and I'm not really very oriented towards sort of producing public facing content. That article was something that had kind of been brewing at the back of my mind for some time. The particular sort of target audience for it, I think, is sort of quite receptive to reading this stuff. So it felt like a good sort of a good exercise in sort of presenting something for the public. Ultimately, though, I've kind of tended to find that I prefer to just keep a low profile, do more writing on my personal blog, which I find a bit more free, really gives me more space to just expand ideas and sort of work on things in a more long-term basis. Who am I? I kind of have two backgrounds, really. Originally, I studied mathematics at university. This was quite a long time ago now. In that process, I kind of got very into sort of logic. And I did a master's in mathematical logic. This is all the kind of Gödel's incompleteness theorem, Alan Turing's theory of computation, this kind of stuff. The sort of motivating concern in my thinking at that point was very much centered around questions of language and epistemology and semantics. And even if I think back all the way to sort of the stoner years in the development of my thought, I was really into these characters like Robert Anton Wilson. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He was a sort of countercultural guy from the 60s who had all these theories about reality tunnels and the idea that the world we experience underdetermines the beliefs we have about it. So in some sense, we have this degree of freedom in what we believe. There are multiple different ways you can conceive reality. Ultimately, I sort of moved on from that into more technical analytic philosophy, which I sort of discovered while studying mathematics. There was quite a crossover between mathematical logic and the stuff that was going on in analytic philosophy at the time, particularly like Wittgenstein, people like this. And so I spent really a long time sort of just diving down those rabbit holes of analytic philosophy. So that's the kind of technical side of my background. More recently, I went back to uni to study fine art, particularly art computing. So in the interim, I had a brief but intense career as a programmer and went back to uni on the basis of a story which is probably quite familiar to people. Worked briefly in the tech industry, found it very unsatisfying and stressful, decided to quit it in search of something more meaningful. So went back to uni to study something creative and found that it was even worse than the thing that I started with. There's something about the world of contemporary art which is uniquely weird, I think. The thing that had previously bothered me about the tech industry is that you spend all day sort of creating stuff and you're supposed to believe in it, but I never really did. Because ultimately you're doing something like making an app that allows someone to buy coffee tiny bit more efficiently. It feels like a big waste of time. You go into the art world and suddenly you are the product. So you're just commodifying yourself even more and more. I personally always found this very, very weird. It's not, I had sort of pursued what I thought would be a more creatively satisfying path, and it actually turned out to be even worse. So this was kind of the point at which my thought became more politicized, because I really wanted to understand what was going in here. What were the goals that had led me to this situation, which actually turned out to be a colossal failure. So that was kind of the moment which my current line of thinking started to crystallize. It's when I began to get more involved with sort of reading Marx, reading critical theory. And one of the things that I've sort of found as I've sort of developed down this path is that actually all that old stuff, all that stuff about language and logic, has a kind of political significance in the present moment, which I hadn't really anticipated. So one thing that I kind of do a lot now is thinking about applying these quite rich, pedantic modes of analysis from analytic philosophy to some of the ideas that were sort of developed in critical theory. And I'm particularly interested in these sort of 70s French authors like Lyotard, Baudrillard, and then subsequently people like Zizek and Badiou. So that's kind of my intellectual biography, I would say.
When writing these pieces, which are great, let me emphasize to our listeners, go and read them. Are you trying to affect something? Is what's in the back of your head that you're trying to affect something, or that you're simply trying to elaborate something for yourself and the effect is incidental? It's probably somewhere in the middle, but which one is really animating?
Primarily, I'm trying to work out what to do. And this is just what to do with myself, essentially. And this is a problem that I've always found remarkably difficult. I'm sure everyone finds it difficult, but I've tried lots of things in life and they all run up against some kind of wall. And I think there's a kind of common structure in the walls that I keep running up against, and I want to understand it.
Okay, so maybe let's jump into the content then. I think the theme that maybe resonates most with me, but I think it's really central to a lot of your writings, is this distinction between structure and agency. And you wrote a really great essay called Structure and Optimism, where you say structuralists obviously focus on structure. Humanists focus on agency, human agency, human actions in the world to affect change. And you say, I think somewhat counterintuitively to the West, at least, or maybe even more broadly, that the cynical one is the humanist, really. And the optimistic one is the structuralist. Which I think, I agree with you, but even saying it, it feels a little edgy to say, doesn't it? Why is that? Can you explain that?
So I think certainly there's this feeling that structuralism is the sort of more inherently pessimistic position. And I think you can think of, for example, there's this very common trope of the melancholic left winger who complains that everything is just tainted by capitalism. But it's such a huge, all-encompassing structure that there's nothing you can really do. So you might as well just have another McDonald's and anesthetize yourself and not do anything. And I think a lot of the thought on the contemporary left is an attempt to get away from the inertia of that position. And it's kind of seen as a structuralist hang-up, a problem of this very strong current in 20th century post-Marxist thought, which was very, very heavily emphasizing structure and structural critique, which kind of seems in certain respects to lead to this place where you've just got this monolithic social thing that you can't affect. So you've just got to kind of deal with it. So I think the impulse on the contemporary left is to emphasize the aspect of action in the world, to say, actually, yes, the difference you can make is very small, but the important thing is you go out there and do something. It's just a drop in the ocean, but an ocean is made of drops. So everyone's got to go just kind of get out there and do stuff. So it's, and this is a very natural way to think about things, I think. But I think there's another way of thinking about things, which is more appealing to me. And the basic problem with the humanist idea, and the humanist idea is essentially that social structures like norms and institutions can be understood in terms of human actions, desires, and beliefs. Whereas the structuralist thinks it's the other way around. So if you want to explain human actions, you need to appeal to social structures like norms, which kind of have some sort of shadowy, autonomous existence on their own. Now, the thing about the humanist position is, for a humanist, if there are big problems in society, they have to conclude that there's problems with people. And this places them in a very difficult rhetorical situation, because in order to respond then to political situations also, they have to convince people that they're not all right. They have to say, basically, you know, these people, there's something wrong with them. They have a sort of spiritual malaise. They're like psychologically not developed enough. They have the wrong desires. They don't know what their desires are. And this kind of doesn't work. There's something very unpersuasive about this. There was a really dramatic example of this in the UK when there was the referendum on leaving the EU. And the campaign, which campaigned for remaining in the EU, basically based their whole campaign was a sort of browbeating tactic, which was just like, oh, this desire to leave the EU, it's coming from these bunch of like idiot bigots. You know, they don't have any legitimate grievances. Don't be an idiot. Any rational person will remote sustain in the EU, and left it at that, more or less. And it failed just spectacularly. And it failed, I think, because it was based on humanist premises. It says, you know, be a better person, essentially. But what it doesn't take into account is that these people perhaps do have legitimate grievances of some sort or another. And you might have to dig quite hard to find out what exactly those are. And so this, I think, gets to the heart of why taking a structural approach to things can actually be more optimistic in a certain sense. Because if conflicts arise for structural reasons, it doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's wrong. Everyone can have legitimate grievances in a conflict. And this sets you up in a position where you're fundamentally attuned to take the other person seriously. And it can make things difficult. It can make structural problems are in many respects more difficult to solve. They're sort of more mysterious, less intuitive. Humanist political tactics are very tractable. It's like, okay, there's this thing that needs to be done, go out and do it. And that's very attractive, I think, for obvious reasons. But the complexity of structuralist thinking, I think, is really just a reflection of the fact that the world is a complex place. And you can't bypass that complexity, I don't think. Fundamentally, the optimism of a structuralist approach is it allows you to treat people as if they're basically all right already. And this means you're immediately talking to them, rather than trying to psychologize them, treat them as an object in some way, an object that needs fixing.
Yeah, that's really well articulated. And to me, it's actually very intuitive. You know, being more of a structuralist leaner myself, the optimism is we can change and transform these dysfunctional structures and systems, and we don't need to change individual people. And even if people are, you know, acting a certain way that's problematic currently, that's due to the influences of the surrounding contextual structures, they're not some kind of essentialized immutable problem with them personally. So I want to introduce another concept into the mix and see where you think this fits into the kind of structure agency debate. And that's this idea of critical consciousness, right? So I was in my book group the other night and we were discussing the relationship between critical consciousness and agency. And at first glance, the two can seem to be rather diametrically opposed, right? Having agency, having this kind of a volitional will to make your life as you will, seems to kind of be run counter, right, to this notion of critical consciousness as a more introspective process, where one might try to deconstruct false structural notions of reality that are actually inhibiting your agency, right? And critical consciousness in the widest possible sense of the term, it could be a classical Marxist class-based sense of critical consciousness, it could be feminist critical consciousness, race-based critical consciousness, et cetera, right? That the critical consciousness is to dispel the false consciousness that you imbibe through being socialized in a faulty system that blinded your perception of reality. But once that's deconstructed, perhaps your own agency can kind of flourish towards revolutionary transformation, right? So I'm wondering how you think of this concept of critical consciousness as a kind of maybe intermediary concept between structure and agency and where it fits into the mix.
Typically speaking, I generally tended to encounter this critical consciousness in this sense as essentially what we're describing is kind of the structuralist mindset in a way. And particularly if you think about contemporary debates on race, this is critical race theory, or the idea of structural racism is a idea which is structural through and through. It says that racist structures, which is to say any self-regulating patterns of behavior which systematically discriminate against some racial groups over others, can exist without anyone having any kind of racism in an internalized sense. It can be implemented just through more or less people being more or less rational in local information environments. These structures can exist nonetheless. Now, the way this kind of gets interpreted in the modern day, it gets sort of reconfigured in a kind of humanist package, which says something like, okay, structural racism is actually just like it's like an unconscious version of overt racism. It's something that you can fix with personal development. You know, do the right workshops, you can get the racism out of you. And of course, this is completely anathema to what the idea of a structural problem is. The question of agency, or like, does being a humanist give you more agency? I guess this is kind of an interesting question. I mean, my answer has to be no, because if social structures exist, then they just exist. Like, if our capacity to act in the world is limited by those social structures. Now, I don't see why being more attuned to them would necessarily make us less able to act if those structures are already constraining our action. I think you could argue, though, that within the context of our society as things stand now, it's kind of more adaptive to take on a humanist mindset. Because in a sense, if you just kind of think or take the attitude that, you know, if I just like focus on my agency in the world, what are the consequences of my action, et cetera, this just fits you in with the norm, I think, in a way which probably means you get rewarded more by society in some way or another. So in a sense, it probably really does increase your agency. But the reason it does so is because of a structure that already exists. So I think the situation is quite complex there. But fundamentally, I think, yeah, underneath that, there's an argument that, you know, thinking too much about these structural things makes us sort of puts us in this kind of a depressive state where you can't do anything because everything seems so monolithic. I don't think that thought is correct. I think if it's doing that, then we haven't understood the structure well enough.
Right. Well, there's kind of a culture war take on this whole debate too, right? This whole idea of that being overly locked into a structural thinking frame basically induces a kind of victim consciousness, right? Like, oh, we can't do anything. You know, I'm screwed because of my circumstances, and therefore I'm not going to exert my agency to transform my personal life and bootstrap and so forth and climb the ladder and make things better for myself. I think there's the kind of moral component really gets in the way too, right? The kind of value sphere of humanism, what humanism is purporting to support in terms of the promise and development of the human potential. I think a lot of conservative types get reactive, thinking that that value sphere is going to be deconstructed by this kind of soulless, you know, cold analytic structuralism. And guys like Andrew Sullivan, right? Like he'll complain and be like, you know, structuralism is a kind of like soulless Marxism that has no place in American politics, right? In favor of a kind of classical liberal humanism.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly, I can kind of see the reasoning, but I just see it as a factual question. Ultimately, it's like if either structures exist or they don't. And if they do, then they're acting, regardless of whether you believe they are or not. I've actually not seen that particular kind of conservative take before.
The one that pops to mind for me is Jordan Peterson, who's not so famous now as he was a few years ago, but I think is still powerful in a sense. versus someone like Zizek, when they had a debate, you know, this big debate, you know, Peterson is an ultimate humanist, and that it all comes down to human action, clean up your room, bucko, and, you know, the 10 rules for your life, which, you know, I think a lot of those rules are good, actually, but he's totally anti-structure, and he sees it all as monolithic. It's all the Marxist, postmodern, whatever he calls it. And then Zizek is the total structuralist, and yet is a much more optimistic person. Zizek is a fun guy, and Jordan Peterson is hopelessly dour. And, you know, these two come together, and it's supposed to be this big fight, and what it comes down to is they're not speaking the same language at all.
That was quite interesting along quite a lot of different axes. One of the things that I found really striking about it is, particularly in the later half, it was remarkable how many points they agreed on. Mm-hmm. In word, and then less so in substance. And in a way, Zizek for a long time has been arguing that one of the central problems with liberal capitalism is that it dissolves the father function. And in a way, this is exactly what Peterson's saying as well. But Zizek interprets this structurally, and Peterson interprets it humanistically. You know, for Zizek, it's all like mired in this sort of structuralist psychoanalysis of Lacan and stuff. And what he means by saying the father function is dissolved is just that it's become structurally impossible to establish authoritative norms. That's kind of what Zizek means, but that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the attitudes or the skills of particular people. Whereas for Peterson, it very much is about that. It's about, you know, a capacity to take on responsibility. But yeah, as you say, at the end of all that, Zizek has this sort of quite optimistic persona, essentially. And essentially that optimism comes through in his just high regard for normal people. And that's a quality that I've always found very, very attractive in thinkers. And you can tell it in Zizek, you can tell, while he references a lot of very high theory, he's also references a hell of a lot of low theory and a lot of TV, sci-fi jokes. And there's a kind of real appreciation, I think, of folk culture in Zizek, which exudes a certain amount of warmth, which I think is ultimately a lot more persuasive.
Let's talk about the meta crisis for our audience. We've been waiting for it, I think. I think there's a similarity with the meta crisis and what Ryan, you mentioned earlier about, you know, I think there's an upfront recognition by a lot of these people, podcasters, writers, who they say the meta crisis is this big, untractable, nebulous problem, and what are we going to do about it? And it requires new forms of thinking and real creativity. But then always the second sentence out of their mouths is like, but what it really comes down to is a problem of education or the psyche or this or that. I don't know what that is, except that the world is complicated and it's easy to recognize the complicatedness, but then you want to say a second sentence. You can't just leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm generally speaking, I'm not against reductive approaches. I think if your problem is like a big tangle, you still got to work out which thread to pull first. I mean, the meta crisis is a term that comes very much from this kind of liminal web area, which is sort of not fully my habitat. So I might go a bit off message here. But I think as a concept, it kind of coheres with a lot of similar concepts that you get coming from other areas. I'm thinking particularly of some of Mark Fisher's ideas about that what characterizes the kind of present moment is this kind of loss of temporality or a cancellation of the future. Badiou has a concept called the crisis of the negative, which kind of taps into something similar. And even like Fukuyama's concept of the end of history is a sort of precursor to something which touches on this idea, which tries to focus in on something which is quite peculiar about the present political moment. If you look at what's kind of common to all these ideas, it's the idea that the present political situation is defined by a kind of this weird absence of the political itself. Like the political sphere itself has kind of deteriorated. There's an absence of any kind of collective subject. And I think that's, to me, is kind of the question that seems very interesting right now. There's the feeling that political life has been reduced to a kind of hollow theater and that there's not really anyone running the show at all. And this is a sense that I think is really very strong in the culture at the moment. The sense of legitimacy that used to be infused in the liberal institutions that society is made of, you know, the media, political party democracy, even science, the kind of perceived public legitimacy of these institutions there's a sense that they've strongly deteriorated, or at least to the point where it's very difficult to achieve any kind of common consensus that these things are good things, even while liberalism kind of remains the horizon in which we are all talking still, at the same time as being the thing that it's the one thing that everyone agrees they hate, right? It's a very peculiar situation to be in. So I think fundamentally, what I think of when we talk about the meta crisis is a situation defined by an absence of a collective subject. And if we wanted to make that a bit more technical, we could say that there's been a kind of deterioration in our capacity to solve collective action problems, or whatever it was, whatever social technologies or institutions that from the past we used to do this with have kind of fallen to pieces a bit. And these seem to be coinciding with the sort of looming presence of these kind of big crises on the horizon, most strikingly the kind of growing geopolitical tension and also climate change, all of which are kind of dependent on solving collective action problems. And this is the very capacity we seem to be losing. And so it's a very interesting and paradoxical political situation, not least because it's multifaceted for a start, but also I think it has a kind of a self-reflexive structure to it, in a sense that our thinking and talking about and producing content about and theorizing about it is part of it. And that creates some complicated loops which make it very difficult to analyze, I think. But it's also what makes it interesting, I think, and it's what makes our political situation something which is very ripe for quite philosophical kinds of analysis.
I want to go back to a comment you made about liberalism as kind of being everyone's enemy, right? I've called it like the kind of sandwich attack on liberalism, where you have conservatives, you know, still blaming the liberals or saying, you know, the liberals have gone off the rails and have now become these kind of woke crazy leftists, right? And you have people on the left who are criticizing the kind of anti-racist, you know, ideology of someone like a Robin DiAngelo as being, oh, these are just a bunch of woke corporate liberals. It's like everyone hates liberals. And I don't really know of anyone who in today's, you know, day and age proudly identifies as a liberal and says, I'm a liberal. You know, Bill Maher did a bit of like reviewing all these Republican ads, and all these guys are saying, I'm a conservative, I'm a proud conservative. He's like, I don't know any Democratic politicians who are like, I'm a liberal, I'm a proud liberal, liberalism, right? And I think part of it really does have to do with the internet, where I think liberalism gets outcompeted by what I've been thinking of as like memetic hypernormal stimuli, right? So things like identitarianism, I think on the right, things like nationalism and you know, kind of strongman authoritarianism, on the far right, things like kind of fascism, and then left, you know, these kind of identity politics. I think these contain more, they have a viral quality that the liberal meme, whatever that means, right? Openness, tolerance, viewpoint diversity, all these kind of classical liberal, you know, John Stuart Mill-esque ideas, just they're not as sexy. They don't have the potency. They don't have as much power to hijack amygdalas. So I think the meme of liberalism is getting kind of deconstructed on both sides. And you kind of have an erosion of the kind of more moderate center that might adhere to more classically liberal views. I think the classical liberal camp does have their champions, but they're mostly kind of the anti-woke, you know, like we need to return to classical liberalism crowd, right? Like the James Lindsays and those guys, right? Sam Harris to a degree, the kind of enlightened centrists, but that still doesn't quite have the kind of memetic virality and to me raw emotive power as does like pure left-wing identity politics like Black Lives Matter, and on the right, like MAGA nationalism.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. I mean, in a way, I think liberalism is a bit like Christianity. It thrives most when it's under attack. So what it's also a very, very broad tradition. So when we think of liberalism, we could mean anything from sort of economic liberalism or neoliberalism to social liberalism, the or political liberalism, the kind of thing that John Stuart Mill was talking about, or we could even be talking about someone like Kant. And there's a gulf that separates Mill and Kant, which is as wide, if not wider, than the one that separates Mill and Hayek or someone like this. So it's a complex system. And I think you could argue, I mean, there's a conspiratorial part of me which wants to say, okay, all this diversification, this hypernormal stimuli, as you're saying, is actually a kind of way that it's just the way that the liberal hegemony works. It diversifies itself in order to attack its parts. You know, it's a hydra, essentially. And this is certainly the way that post-Marxist theorists have attempted to analyze capitalism. You sometimes hear this point that gets made quite often where people will talk about prefix capitalism. You know, you have platform capitalism, crony capitalism, and people critique these things. And there's a certain left-wing argument which says, well, this is the hydra just presenting another head for you to cut off so that the rest can carry on over here. You know, really, like, it's capitalism in itself. I think liberalism is in many ways kind of the same beast. The other point here, I think, is that liberalism itself contains a lot of internal contradictions. Wherever you're standing within it, you can critique a different part of it. Particularly, I'm of the view, I'm kind of generally speaking pretty on board with political liberalism. I think the problems come from trying to merge political liberalism and economic liberalism. And I think these two things are actually in tension, and that fundamentally free markets destroy the public sphere, which undermines the enabling conditions of political liberalism. That's my view of kind of what's happening here, essentially, is you're watching one part of liberalism destroy the other part. But yeah, as far as, I think there's an interesting point there about the internet and how, what's the point in endorsing the status quo? And one way you could talk about this is as a stimuli, like a sort of as a sort of political hit. You know, you're gonna go on Twitter and like argue some extreme viewpoint, and it might as well be as extreme as it can be, because otherwise, what's the point? But I think you could also look at it from the point of view of social signaling, and you could argue that what's really going on here is that liberalism has kind of advanced to such a stage where we sort of live in the era of capitalism now. It's not really, we're not in Marx's era. It's not about industry, like building stuff and shipping it around the planet, although that's still happening. But in Western democracies, what's really going on is we're in this sort of world of social capitalism, which is dictated by fashion cycles. And within that context, value accrues to people who differentiate themselves. So there's kind of a structural incentive for maximal differentiation. So I would say that what might explain this kind of phenomenon of the constant bifurcation and intensification of different political viewpoints is simply a structural incentive for increased diversity. Because the thing that earns you value in the context of a fashion cycle is to maximally differentiate yourself from everything that is already there while still speaking more or less the same grammar, something like that. So I think what you get is this kind of constant variation on pre-existing forms. And this happens with ideas as with anything else. And I think it happens a lot in the context of political ideas. So that would be perhaps my thought on why that might happen.
Yeah, that hit home. It hits home, man. Like, I find myself, like, whenever I'm thinking about, like, writing something, and I think, well, obviously someone else could write that. I don't write that thing. I only ever want to write something that only I could write, or that I perceive only I could write. But then I write it, and someone comes along and says, isn't this basically blah, blah, blah? I'm like, yeah, I guess it is. I guess it is. You caught me, you know.
And it's a real paradox. And this is, you know, this is part of one of the reasons why I don't really try to produce much, because the moment that I start doing that, I feel captured by those incentives. And I'm like, oh God, got to publish stuff and got to write a follow-up, got to expand this idea. And if I just sit back and do things in my own little corner, things grow much slower and more organically. And ultimately I think better. So trying to step out of that structure, that what is essentially an incentive structure, I think is quite a good idea to not get trapped by it.
It's the reason that I think we hesitated for a long time to invite you on this podcast, though we've been reading your work the whole time, is there is that sense, you know. And you even write in some of your writings, like, that this logic is epitomized in the logic of the podcast, as opposed to, say, something like Reddit or something like that, where anonymity is kind of central, and the point is to say something sensible and reasonable, and that's how you get likes, not something interesting per se. And I like that, but that's boring, you see. And I used to have a Reddit, and now I don't ever use it, and I do this all the time.
Yeah, essentially, like, I would, and this is a paradox that I grapple with quite a lot, because, you know, if I'm thinking, okay, what if I wanted to just redesign how all this worked from scratch, I would basically just design Web 1, mm-hmm. Yeah. where you have these big message boards where everyone kind of knows each other in their anonymous form. There's kind of a real sense of accountability, in the sense that if you say something stupid, you're going to look like an idiot, and it's going to stay there forever. There's a proper representation of temporality. Conversations don't disappear until they're finished. And even then they get resurrected in the future. Kind of grapple with here is that at some point we chose to stop doing that, and we moved onto all these much faster media, onto social media, where you have no representation of temporality at all, really. Everything just sort of fades into a past, which makes it very difficult for the past to hold the present to account in a way, which I think is one of the qualities that you need for good conversations. But the thing is, this is the answer. The reason is, it's much more fun. And it really is. It's hard work engaging with old style forums. Like, writing like long form text is like heavy, heavy work. But there's this flip side where it gets better results in the end. Or I'm not even sure I want to say better. It's more the point, what they force everyone to do is to talk in the same conversation rather than constantly starting new ones. And that's kind of the basic quality I think you need for building a movement, pushing forward an idea in a way that's actually substantial, that carves into the details and actually figures out all the problems. But it's incredibly hard work. And when you contextualize this in terms of the sort of general economic, socioeconomic situation that people are in, they're either, you know, how much time do people really have? You're either sort of working really hard, working long days, or you're sort of maybe in a sort of more middle-class, prestige-hungry environment where you work even longer days. And to move over to this easier media, which is in a sort of short-term basis, but it's problematic on a long-term basis. So there's a big structural tangle there, which is difficult to work out, I think.
All right. Yeah, I wanted to return to our earlier question about your take on the kind of breakdown of collective action, or at least collective action and cooperation that's needed at scale to solve some of these meta crisis challenges. And I'm wondering, what are some of the main analytic lenses or frameworks that you use to diagnose and really make sense of these collective action breakdowns, right? So everyone has kind of like their lens of choice, right? So some people like to talk about the scale of 21st century human civilization that throws our genetic and evolutionary wiring out of whack, because that's not the environment that our ancestors evolved in. Other people talk about it from a more of a complexity or network lens, right, where we have all of these entanglements and interconnections between different parts of the system, which can lead to cascading failures and the need for kind of autonomy at a more local level, a la subsidiarity, right? There are game theoretic angles, right, considering Nash equilibria and multipolar traps, prisoner's dilemma, race to the bottom, arms races that destroy the commons, that where people are incentivized and not cooperate, right? So I'm kind of wondering, what is kind of your main angle that you use to understand the meta crisis and collective action breakdown?
I'm certainly primarily pretty preoccupied with rational decision theory, of which game theory is a sort of subset, I guess. It just strikes me that the insights that we have from that field give us the absolute clearest articulation of why these things go wrong. And the prisoner's dilemma in particular, I think, is an idea that has just absolutely changes the way you have to think about everything. It's kind of impossible to ignore. But I find the lessons that people take from it to be kind of strange sometimes. So of course, what this thought experiment shows us essentially is that collective action is fundamentally really difficult. It's not something I think that we can, when it fails, we shouldn't posit a problem with people. And so in a sense, I think it's a real articulation of the kind of structuralist point that actually these kind of problems have their own logical structure. They're not dependent necessarily on things like psychology. So yeah, decision theory, I think, is the right way, it seems to me, to think about social structure. I think one thing you see a lot at the moment, particularly in sort of liminal web, Hansi style stuff, is the prevalence of things like developmental psychology, often merged with some kind of complexity theory. The way this kind of works as a setup is usually based on some kind of kinetic metaphor. If you think of like how water turns into a gas, you know, each molecule has got to get up to the right level of kinetic energy, and then you have a phase transition and it turns from a water into a gas. And I think these kind of metaphors are kind of in the background, and you can see how it would work. You have these sort of developmental stages that people go through, and it's kind of all a question of like getting enough people up to the right level, and then society itself will go through some kind of phase transition. So this connects the idea of developmental psychology to cultural development. And that's a very humanist way of thinking about things. It's like deeply, deeply, deeply humanist. Get enough people to the right level, society will change. But it's fundamentally a very confusing way, I think, of thinking about social structure and what it is. And if we think about what complexity science really is an incredibly general way of thinking about phenomena in the world and thinking about morphogenesis and the development of form in general. And this, the principles that you describe in complexity theory apply to hurricanes, organisms, embryology, societies, planets, geological strata. They apply to everything. So when you try to apply this to something like social structure, you're necessarily throwing out all the thing that is unique about social structure. So it's a bit like if you want to make some crystals, you can describe that whole process in terms of complexity theory, in terms of like feedback loops and stuff. But if you actually want to intervene in that process, you have to do some chemistry. So in the social context, the question is, what's kind of the equivalent of the chemistry in that case? And I think the answer ultimately is rationality. The thing that makes humans different from molecules is that humans are agents, rational agents who send signals and can do things like deceive each other. And I think this makes the situation really very different. And we should be very wary of using sort of these kinetic metaphors for thinking about social change, because molecules don't have norms, essentially. Humans do have norms, and this changes things radically. Now, decision theory, I think, is a very powerful way of thinking about norms, and it provides some very good tools for doing so. And in particular here, I have in mind some of the ideas of Thomas Schelling about Schelling points and common knowledge. And the thing about common knowledge, just to recap, a group has common knowledge if they all know that P, and they all know that they know that P, and they know that each other knows that they know that P, and so on and so on. It's important about this nation. I might want to do something. That person over there might want to do something. We might want to do it together, but unless that we know that we each know that we want to do it, we won't necessarily make the decision to do it. And I think when you start thinking about problems in these terms, you see this kind of stuff everywhere. It becomes a bit like a sort of universal acid that you can just see happening all over the place in the way things work, all over. When we think about, for example, a phenomenon like this thing that the media fumbles after with the term post-truth, which describes a kind of situation where accountability in the public sphere doesn't really work anymore. You can kind of see this as a failure of common knowledge production. It's one thing to stand up on a stage as a politician, say, and make a promise. Yeah, to stand up and make a promise. Then you come back next week and you do something different. The question then is, how is the public sphere as a sort of complete entity able to use that past commitment to hold the present action to account? This, to do so, it requires common knowledge of what was said in the first place. So the idea, this kind of idea of a public memory is retained in common knowledge is kind of what's essential to make the present accountable to the past. And I think a lot of what's going on at the moment is you're just having a breakdown of common knowledge specifically. And that accounts for a lot of why you have this kind of deterioration of norms in the public sphere. And I think a lot of the confusion on this topic comes from a tendency to conflate normal knowledge, individual knowledge, with common knowledge. So for example, in order to produce common knowledge among a group of people, one thing you really need are information bottlenecks. Because if you're sitting in a room with a TV and there's 20 of you in there, every single thing that comes through that TV, you're not just getting that information. You're also getting the meta information that tells you that everyone else is seeing that information as well. So this is kind of the role of bottlenecks in producing common knowledge. And I think actually one thing that the internet has done has actually made everyone a lot better informed. I don't buy the idea that people are kind of become more stupid or have like gone off, been sort of radicalized because, you know, they're vulnerable or whatever. I think really what's happened is the internet has made everyone much better informed, but they've been informed in a very, very personalized way. So what happens is you're basically buying individual knowledge at the price of destroying common knowledge. And I think this is kind of one of the reasons why coordination becomes very, very difficult, because everyone is kind of too well informed in a way, but they're informed in a way which is completely tailored to them. And I think we've only seen the beginning of this, particularly if these sort of new AI language models start doing tailor-made news feeds. You can imagine a situation where everyone knows exactly what they want to know, and they're really well informed, and they're very articulate about expressing their ideas within their own vocabulary formed by their information environment. But everyone's information environment is completely disjoint. There is no common vocabulary anymore. And because of this, you can't actually communicate with one another. And I think this comes back to this problem of bifurcation. It's wrong, I think, to think of this problem in the information environment as being a problem of quality or even a problem of disinformation. It's simply a problem of quantity. There's just too much of it, and it's too personalized, and it's not bottlenecked. Now, this kind of raises a lot of problems, because bottlenecks are historically problematic for different reasons. It raises all these questions of who's going to control it. If you have state media, then, you know, this raises all sorts of questions of accountability and stuff. So the problem here is almost one of how do you produce common knowledge in a decentralized way? And that's a really difficult problem to solve, I think. But certainly framing it in these terms is a very useful way, I think, of highlighting what matters in the situation.
Oh, that was beautifully articulated. So a couple of thoughts, right? I think you explained the information bottleneck phenomena really well in terms of how that is actually an important driver to produce common knowledge or meta-knowledge, right? That I know that you know that I know. How I think about it too, in terms of the reality tunnel problem, is that I think you do see a personalized information stream on your own media platform. But there's also for political issues, there is crossover, right? So let's say people in the Black Lives Matter community in their kind of bubble or their tribal pocket will share common knowledge and all go to the rally together. And then people from the Proud Boys or from, you know, at a Trump rally, you know, MAGA supporters, they'll have their own. So it's like people are organizing in their own way, like the kind of classic example in terms of common knowledge facilitating coordination in terms of people showing up at a protest that could be dangerous, right? I'm only going to go if I know enough of my people are going to go with me. And if not, then I'm not going to go. So there also has to be an element of trust. Like, okay, we both know of the protest, but I have to trust you're going to show up. And everyone else is from the other side is going to do the same thing too. So to me, it's almost like we have there is a collective coordination, but in too much of a balkanized and antagonistic way. There can't be mass coordination about the real big issues we need to solve, like climate change, right? So I'm wondering how you think of those different, like kind of fractally, and the fragmentation that comes from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's interesting there that the examples you chose were from the right, because actually I think one of the features of the last, say, decade of sort of political life is that actually the right wing have been much better at this, generally speaking, than the left. And my kind of as someone who is more or less identifies as a kind of left-wing person, I see one of the challenges of left-wing political thought at the moment is to understand why the right have been more successful at creating common knowledge, essentially. And one of the reasons I think might be that the dominance of progressive norms in public spaces has actually forced the right wing to talk to each other directly. So I have a feeling that in this way, the kind of this dominance of progressive norms in public space, and I do think it is a dominance, actually, certainly in the kind of cultural spheres, the more elite spheres, which is kind of what matters, I think, in a sense, for setting the tone for everywhere else. Right wing views or even conservative views are considered often like unacceptable to peculiar degrees. And I think one of the effects of this has been to create a lot of sort of underground substructures and infrastructure within right-wing movements. And that has actually been one of the reasons why they've been quite successful, I think, relatively successful at forming movements and in certain cases, taking power.
So an example popping to mind and pretty relevant right now is Roe versus Wade is looking like it's about to be overturned. And this has been a long effort by conservatives working at this precedent, whereas you never saw any kind of defensive equal on the liberal side. But then also, you know, there's that example, but then there's the example of the January 6th stormers, you know, who, yeah, they coordinated it, but it's basically just the logic of the swarm that they say, are we all doing this? Yes, we are. Here we are, busting through the windows, you know, which, you know, maybe that's the lowest common denominator that we can, that liberals and conservatives, the left and the right, can do in this day and age is like, well, we're all doing it, you know, like the protest is like basically the lowest common denominator.
Yes. And I think the thing that's kind of, that's interesting about these events is that when they happen, everyone thought they were impossible right up until the moment that they actually happen. And in a way, I think this is always what we can expect from something which is a genuine political event. If it seemed likely in advance, that means it was already in some sense a recombination of the situation as it already was, I think. So in a sense, anytime something happens, there is an exercise, I think, of collective agency. We should always expect it to feel like it arrives kind of from the future, like this shouldn't have been possible at all. And I think certainly Brexit felt like that. The sort of the level of shock was really quite palpable. I imagine the Trump election must have felt very similar as well. Like it's just a ridiculous joke right up until the moment that it comes real.
Which is history, you know. And how many people were saying at that time, Francis Fukuyama is the most dunked on commentator in the whole world in 2016. The return of history.
Yeah, although, I mean, the thing is, I mean, the funny thing about Fukuyama is, I remember particularly if back in like sort of 2003 or something, everyone was dunking on Fukuyama because it was after, you know, after 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, everyone was like, oh my God, history has started again. Even Baudrillard said that, and he never says that. But I think what we've seen in the years since is actually an incredible robustness to the status quo, which we could sort of maybe, sort of the neoliberal axis set up by Reagan and to an extent Thatcher in the late 80s. There was 9/11, which I think was more of a symbolic thing than anything else, though we shouldn't underestimate symbolic events. 2008, the Trump election. It's recovered from these shocks remarkably well. And at any one of them, you could imagine someone proclaiming the end of the liberal or neoliberal order. And I don't think it's going anywhere. I think the predictions of collapse are based on, of social collapse anyway, are based on a model of how this kind of hegemony works, which is perhaps inaccurate. I think it sort of lives in a state of almost appearing to fall apart at any given moment. But actually, every time it does this, it's almost like it just sort of swallows something up and carries on. I think it's quite remarkable, actually.
At a certain point, though, you can only swallow up so much. As you say, the one head of the Hydra will, you know, if it it takes over everything, then the system dies, right? You know, it just breathes in so much that it will collapse. And this is what Nick Land and, you know, all the accelerationists are all about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, logically speaking, at some point it's got to collapse. But I think there's certainly been a theme in thinking about this, which dates back to Marx predicting that, you know, capitalism would create the conditions for its own disintegration. Everyone thought that was going to happen by like the 50s. And it just got, you know, more and more extreme every time. And if I were putting my bets down, I would say that the system is much more robust than it appears to be. But obviously, at some point, there's a limit.
I'm still thinking about the kind of rational ritual question and information and collective action problems and coordination problems. Yeah, I'm thinking about, like, I want to bring in this, now I want to talk about incentive structures, because I know this is something you've thought about a lot, right, Sam? And one thing I find very interesting is the conversation around, like, libertarian Austrian economics and how they think about those market mechanisms in terms of facilitating some kind of collectively beneficial outcome, i.e. the invisible hand, right? Whether it's towards facilitating, you know, allocative efficiency in the market and having the right competitive dynamics between competing individual firms, or having the right incentive structures that come about of, you know, on the part of individual firms from those competitive dynamics, having the right kind of signaling mechanics, right? Market signals, price signals to mediate supply demand ratios, et cetera. And then there's a selection mechanism of, like, what businesses, what goods, right, get upregulated and which ones get downregulated and weeded out of the market ecosystem. And one of the ideas of this is that what I find very cool, of course, the theory doesn't totally work in practice, because a lot of these, you know, Adam Smith and David Ricardo's had a kind of limited perspective on commons. And so they didn't really take into consideration the full amount of negative externalities that would be produced by unfettered capitalism. But I do think that the fundamental premise is actually a really, really cool idea, where the idea of free market mechanisms turning, you know, people's individual selfish utility maximizing motives into some kind of collectively beneficial outcome based on what Hayek calls tacit knowledge, right? So people are operating all in their own zones, but the information that you have personally is actually, when mediated through the market, can unintentionally lead to beneficial collective outcomes. And I think that's a really cool concept. So what I've joked about on this podcast multiple times is it possible to have a system that's like a more holistic invisible hand that can act as a kind of externality transmutation machine? And I don't know if you have thoughts on that line of thinking, or if you have an idea of what that could look like.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question that I think gets to the heart of a lot. And I totally agree with you that the market is one of the most powerful social technologies that's ever been created. And it is fundamentally a coordination technology, which, as you say, it does through, you know, pricing signals. It's like a distributed computation. The Hayek stuff on this is fantastic. So one thing I've written about this a little bit is, I think there's a danger here that we can confuse two different kinds of coordination. And I've kind of tended to call these social coordination and economic coordination. And I can sort of articulate this through the idea of a prisoner's dilemma. So I think when you have sort of market or economic coordination, what you're doing is trying to design the incentives in such a way that everyone's self-interest converges on a Nash equilibria that's socially desirable. And you can kind of gerrymander this process by setting things up in the first place so that you can sort of avoid the pitfalls that come with, like, bad Nash equilibria. So you can sort of set things up so you don't have prisoner's dilemma type situations arising in the first place. And that's kind of, I think, is sort of behind a lot of the impetus around a lot of libertarian thought, but even more so around Web3 and crypto equity systems and all this stuff. However, I think there is a kind of Marxist counterpoint to this idea, which I think is quite a powerful one. And what it says essentially is that when we use these market mechanisms, the thing that allows them to work is that we communicate, or we signal our value hierarchies in a medium on a scale, on a single scale, right? And this is when we trade money for stuff, basically. And by doing that, what it means is all our value hierarchies get sort of flattened down onto a single scale. And this is what allows for this very frictionless information transfer that the market uses to great effect. But what we shouldn't forget is that we've done something at that point. This very process of flattening all our values down onto a single scale, we've lost one particular ability. And that's the ability to signal unconditional values. Because what we're saying, whenever we do something, whenever we buy the vegan burger instead of the beef burger, is we're saying we'll pay $3 more for a little bit more ethical good. So what we have not done ever with that signal is communicated an unconditional value. We have never actually communicated something, a moral value, for example, which like, you know, that say if you're a vegan for ethical reasons, you'll say that, you know, you should just never do this. Like it's never good to be complicit in an animal suffering. And that's a kind of red line. It's an unconditional value, but you can't signal that on a market because you can only express yourself through market activity, which is buying and selling things, basically. And there are no discontinuities in that value medium because they're all flattened on a single scale. And one of the things that I think is really great about Marx's original analysis is that it points to this and it extracts so much from it. Or at least, I'm not sure if that's really in Marx's analysis, but it's kind of implicit in it. It's drawn out, particularly in a lot of the post-Marxist stuff that came in the second half of the 20th century. And particularly in Baudrillard, who I think really, who drives this line of thought really, really far. And is one of the reasons why he's kind of my absolute favorite thinker. So the idea here really is when we're doing, and morality is a really good example, I think, because what does moral coordination really consist in? And I think the answer is that it has to involve communicating unconditional values, rules, hard rules, because otherwise, if you have a very utilitarian-based morality, which is the kind of, you know, Mill onwards, the liberal kind of standard, you have this problem of coordination, essentially. This is a critique of utilitarianism that was first put forward by a guy called Alan Gibbard. And the idea is that if you have a bunch of utilitarians and they all know each other are utilitarians, it's all common knowledge that they are utilitarians, then they don't really have any reason to keep their agreements because none of their values are unconditional. Because to be a utilitarian means you can always, you judge each action on its own basis, on its consequences, and there's never any unconditional, like you can never just say murder is wrong because you might have to murder someone to save five people, right? So there are no hard lines. But the problem with this is it's very difficult to coordinate with someone who doesn't express any unconditional values. The line of thought here that I think is kind of implicit in Marx and gets drawn out by people like Baudrillard is that what the market does essentially is it turns us into de facto utilitarians. And this makes moral coordination impossible, essentially because it deprives us of our ability to communicate unconditional values or discontinuities in our value hierarchies. And I think this is a really good line of argument, which places a kind of hard constraint on what we can expect to achieve from markets or market-like systems. And it defines also the difference, I think, between economic coordination and social coordination. The question then is, what does it take to do social coordination? And social coordination, I would kind of define as cooperating in a prisoner's dilemma. Something like mechanism or market design tries to arrange things so prisoner's dilemmas don't come up in the first place. Social coordination is about an exercise of kind of trust in quite a specific sense of that word, which is basically doing something which is irrational from the point of view of self-interest to achieve something which is socially desirable. And that's kind of the essence of what I would consider to be group rationality. That group rationality is something that can't really be modeled by markets, I don't think, because the way markets work is precisely controlling the way that you can communicate information to each other, which doesn't allow you to communicate these discontinuities, which are crucial for group coordination. Does that make sense? It's a bit convoluted, that one.
Well, I have a quote here from you. I like reading people their own quotes, which I think it says it pretty concisely, a lot of what you just said. You said, collective action requires more than individuals with conviction. It also requires individuals who are confident of one another's conviction. But this confidence, and that's like that's the real kernel of like the prisoner's dilemma, you know?
It's the trust part.
Yes, the trust. But this confidence is precisely what is undermined by our noisy information environment. And I would say even more by the fact that nowadays we talk to so many, we can talk to anyone in the world, as opposed to 400 years ago when we lived in a little village and we were talking to Frank who lives next door. If Frank screws me over on this deal, I'm not going to like Frank for the rest of my life. I'm going to tell everybody else that Frank is not trustworthy. So that's like a bare kind of trust, like bare physical there he is kind of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the particular kind of trust that you're talking about. This is I go around in circles reading your work on trust specifically, thinking like, what is it that he's exactly gesturing to here?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the way trust is used kind of colloquially, you can use a concept of trust, which is perfectly applicable in sort of business or market context, where you can say, okay, now that we've both invested in this thing, I can trust that the other person is going to act in a certain way. But what we're talking about there is not what I would call trust. This is just prediction. This is, okay, I understand that the rational incentives now mean that this person is likely to do that thing. Whereas when trust in this context, we're talking about, do I trust someone else to act in a way that conforms to agreement that we've made, even when it conflicts with their self-interest? So that's kind of the distinction here. And I think we actually have, I like using really boring examples for this because there's loads of this kind of stuff that happens in our just day-to-day lives all the time. And one example I particularly like is the idea of when you're just like deciding on a restaurant for dinner and you're a group of friends. And when we do this, we absolutely are not reasoning from rational self-interest. We sort of, you reason collectively, everyone has their own ideas of what they want, but is kind of taken as a given that whatever the group decides is binding on everyone, regardless of what people actually want. And I think when you have a situation like this, it almost stops making sense to talk about what people want as individuals, because you almost give up the authority of your own desire when you enter a group reasoning process. And in that kind of context, I wonder what sense it even makes to talk about desire anymore of the individual. The desire now belongs to the group. And that kind of process is the kind of thing that requires trust. And trust is believing that other people will respect the consensus, even if they didn't want that in the end, if that makes sense.
The Japanese are very good at doing this. We will suppress any personal desire in order to not stick our heads out too much and conform to the group. If the nail sticks out, we'll be hammered down, right?
Yeah, but then you all say, it doesn't matter to me, it doesn't matter to me, it doesn't matter to me. And then you all just look at each other like, so what are we doing? And Sam, you're right about this. There's a certain kind of, I forget the term you used, but it's in your piece, In Place of Conversation. Like, that's just as bad as everybody being dogmatically for pizza or Italian or Chinese.
Yes, I think so. I think the phrase I was using there was reductive collectivism. And in this case, in this kind of case, is where you've got to get this kind of failure of group reasoning, where the group or the collective is treated as this kind of reified entity, which has the all the authority comes from this abstract thing, which is the group. And then what happens is people just turn up. No one recognizes the input of their own authority as constituting this entity called the group. So no one has any opinions, so nothing happens. And so, yeah, I think what you see from that kind of example is that there's two ways that this kind of process can fail. One of which I think is what we might call reductive individualism, or perhaps voluntarism, which is like, okay, people are just rationally self-interested actors. Everyone's got their own ideas of what they want. The best we can do is use mechanisms like the market to align our desires. Or there's this other problem of reductive collectivism, where everyone just sort of treats the group as if it's like this other entity which will decide what they do, and then there's no actual gas in the machine at all and nothing happens. So yeah, it's these banal examples are quite useful, I think.
I like that example. And I like the example also that you use as sort of a middle ground between the monolithic norm of the group versus the purity and realness of desire as like the sibling bond. You said a sibling bond is sort of the logic of how we should all be trying to relate to each other, how we should try to structure systems so that we relate to each other, which is like, it's symmetric. It's you recognize each other and you want the best for each other, but you also fight and it's rivalrous and your own desires are obviously holy when you're talking to your brother or your sister.
Yeah, so the context of that quote was, yes, so what we're getting at here are three ways of thinking about authority. One of them, I think, is the kind of what I was calling reductive collectivism is typically associated with the kind of traditionalist position, which is like, okay, the norms are these things that just exist. They're handed down by the past and you've just got to do it. You know, your desire is irrelevant. And the problem with that kind of thing is that they often fail to exercise any legitimate authority, because why would I consider a norm legitimate that I don't have any stake in? And that's kind of the typical image of that norm is of that mode of authority is kind of paternal authority. It's the kind of Oedipal structure, you know, where, you know, the father just says, do it or else. The other, that was what I call the hard objectivism of tradition. The other, the kind of problem of modernity, I think more so is the other pole, which is this subjectivism of desire, where the only authority that anything, the only reason you have to do anything is your own desire. And this, you know, you can trace this idea maybe to Hume. This is kind of Hume's kind of concept of practical reason. It's like you never have a reason to do anything unless you want to. Even moral reasons, like a moral reason is never valid unless you want to be moral. This is the kind of Humean idea of things. And the problem with this is more subtle, I think. But yeah, maybe this is a good time to talk about Wittgenstein. There's this absolutely wonderful argument that Wittgenstein makes in his later work called the private language argument, which for me is sort of up there with the prisoner's dilemma. It's just one of the cleverest things I think I've ever read. And this argument is fundamentally about rules and rule following and what it takes to follow a rule. It's made in the context of language, but Saul Kripke, who's another analytic philosopher, published a quite famous book which expanded on this idea and generalized it into a general rule following paradox. And the idea here is really that if you're the only person who gives yourself a rule, then you really have no reason to follow it. If on Monday you decide that you want to quit smoking, that's fine. Comes on Friday and you decide that you want a cigarette, what reason do you really have to prefer the past desire to the present desire? The answer is none, really. If you have the authority to give yourself a rule, then you also have the authority to unbind yourself from the rule or just reinterpret the rule as, you know, I won't smoke except on Fridays. And there's really nothing you can do about this. It's, and what I really like about the way this argument is phrased by Wittgenstein and then Kripke is that it makes it clear that this has got nothing to do with willpower. It's not about a capacity. It's not about being developed or developing your authority over yourself. It's a logical problem that derives from the fact that you only have a single locus of account. And the idea here is then that, you know, what happens when you have conflicting desires? Which one do you prefer? If desire is the only locus of authority over your actions, then these kind of problems are not possible to resolve. They can't be. So I think what this tells us is that desire can't be the sole source of authority. Norms have to have some kind of, they're not reducible to desire. I'll put it that way. They're not like averages of desire, for example. So the idea of the sibling bond is a way of thinking about a kind of third kind of authority structure, which is fundamentally reciprocal in nature. So rather than me placing the rule on myself, I have to acknowledge the authority of someone else to hold me accountable to the rules that I place on myself. So it's fundamentally about giving someone the authority over me. And you get a kind of version of this idea comes up in like sort of startup culture a little bit, or when people work in like shared working spaces and they'll have like accountability circles where they'll sort of stand up and say, okay, I'm going to achieve this by the end of the day. And I think they've done some studies that show that when you do this, when you publicly vocalize a goal, you're more likely to stick to it. And it's an interesting question, because there's a sense in which, what is this sense in which we give authority to someone else? In a way, it can't just be a choice, because if it was, you'd be back in the paradox. Because if I choose to give you the authority over me on Monday, I could just retract that authority on Friday when I want to do something different. So there's a sense in which I think this deferral of authority to the other has to happen in some sense unconsciously. And I think we get a sense of the intuition behind this when we look at, for example, these kind of online traditionalist type people, and they're sort of saying, okay, there's no more norms in society. We're just going to choose this one and just stick to it, full guns blazing. And it seems there's something quite weird about doing that, because it seems like you can't really choose a norm, or if you do, then there's no way that it can really be a binding norm, because you could just unchoose it whenever you want to. So there's a kind of paradox in here, in that in some sense, norms have to be unconsciously acknowledged, whatever that means, in order to be binding. And this is an idea which I've been thinking about a lot recently, primarily through the work of Robert Brandom, who's an analytic philosopher, who's a kind of quite a big dog in that world. He's recently written this absolutely massive tome on Hegel. And it's a really, really amazingly pedantic and clear, and this very massive logical edifice. But what he does is he reads Hegel as a philosopher of normativity. This allows him to reinterpret this historical story that Hegel tells about the development of Geist or spirit, which is often read as a sort of as a development of social institutions or norms. And the way he makes this point is something like this. He says, the thing that characterizes pre-modern conceptions of normativity is that norms are treated as things which just exist in nature. They're not produced by sort of human desires or attitudes at all. They're just kind of there. And the typical example would be like the divine right of kings. It's just a fact about this guy that, you know, his line of birth means he's in charge. That's just a fact. Now, the interesting thing about this situation is that while it is in a sense false, this guy doesn't really have any special authority, but if people think that he does, then he will. So there's this sort of sense that the false belief in natural norms actually has the effect of instituting real binding norms. So this is the way Brandom reads Hegel as seeing as the basic structure of traditional moral life. Norms are treated as things found in nature. This is incorrect, but it works, essentially. Now, the problem with it is that because norms are treated as found in nature, it's impossible to resolve conflicts. And this is the kind of dominant motif in Greek tragedy. You know, someone is caught between contradictory duties. There's no way of resolving the conflict. Therefore, everyone has to die. That's kind of what happens a lot in Greek tragedies. And this is basically because norms are in fact created by people's attitudes, but they're treated as if they're found. But you can't find them anywhere, so you can't resolve the conflicts. And the way this story then progresses is that Hegel sees modernity as being fundamentally defined by a shift in this structure of authority. So what happens in modernity, Hegel thinks, is that we start to have true beliefs about the source of our norms. norms in modernity are understood as being produced by our subjective attitudes. They're norms that we, in a sense, project onto nature. They don't exist before we come along. They're things that they exist because we take them to. And the problem with this then is that it undercuts the force of those norms. So there's this kind of paradox here in which pre-traditional life was defined by the mistake that works, and modern life is defined by the truth that undermines our very constitution as normative beings. And I think this is actually a really insightful way of thinking about the paradox of modernity. So the challenge then, when you see things like this, is how do you have real norms, actually binding norms that in practice people take seriously, at the same time as understanding that those norms are produced by you? And choice really presents a problem here, because if you just choose your norms, then it doesn't work. Then you hit the rule following paradox. So there's a kind of real challenge there. And that's why Brandon Rees Hegel, as kind of in the phenomenology of spirit, as trying to articulate a third way. And that's kind of how he reads Hegel's project. And one of the key elements of that project is this concept of mutual recognition, which this image of the sibling bond is a kind of thematization of, where you have a reciprocal structure where people in sort of dyadic unions recognize the authority of the other to hold them to account to the norms they place on themselves. And the idea is that when you have this, this recognizes both the fact that norms are produced by human attitudes, but it allows them to be actually binding. So that's kind of the idea behind the sibling bond there.
Very interesting. I'm so sorry. I had to run to the bathroom, so I might have missed something crucial. I drank too much coffee.
It's all right.
So let me ask you this about the this idea of natural norms, or norms being kind of ontologized in nature, that are beyond human manufacturing, and kind of the binding power of that. Let me just see if I'm thinking about this in the right context. Is that akin to like natural law theory?
I'm not familiar with natural law theory.
Well, actually, I think you touched on it. Maybe you were in the bathroom. I don't remember. You're talking about the divine right of kings.
Like this. Yes. I mean, yes, absolutely. So I think, you know, the term that Marx used for this was a fetish. It's when you treat what is essentially a product of your attitudes as if it was something found in nature. And I think you see this a lot, actually. I think this actually sort of folds back into the kind of humanist question, particularly if we return to this whole kind of developmental psychology thing. There's, you know, in recent years, there's been all this within the liminal space, there's been all this controversy about the nature of developmental psychology and what role it should or can play in a kind of political or cultural theory. And the complaint generally seems to be that it's developmental psychology is supposed to be descriptive, but in practice it functions as a kind of normative thing,
right?
Where people are judged on the basis of like which color they are or whatever. This, I think, is an example of problem that humanist thought gets into, because it kind of can't really appeal directly to norms. It can't just say, you know, you should be nice to people because you just should. It ends up saying something like, you have to be nice to people because that's more healthy. And often what you find is this kind of this substitution for talk about what's right, for talk about what's healthy. And then everyone quite rightly finds this a bit weird because it feels normative. And the reason I think is because it is. So I think this idea of the fetish, the norm, which is naturalized in a sense, it is treated as a natural property of the world. And if you don't obey it, you're just wrong. It's a kind of cognitive error. I think this really is something that recurs over and over again.
Yeah. What's interesting about, from what I understand about Marx's theory of commodity fetishism, was there's two parts to it, right? There's making a certain object, in this case, the commodity, and the exchange value that mediates the commodity, kind of hyper salient, at the expense of the labor forces that produce the commodity. So one life world, right, that we can see the world of market exchange value kind of runs roughshod or steamrolls the kind of life world of labor. And so, and through that, that is kind of how false consciousness is induced on us, because we make one thing very vivid while everything gets marginalized or shoved out, shoved into the background, right? So there's kind of a dual factor. And I think that's where I think about the concept of fetishization is always occurring in any instance of oppression, right? One side of the polarity that's favored becomes in your face, and the other side gets shoved into the background, and then you can no longer, it's out of sight, out of mind. And you just missed out on a huge part of reality, right? You missed out on a huge part of the system is just totally occluded from your awareness.
Yes, and I think this is like a major theme in a lot of the kind of structural critiques of things like structural racism or patriarchy, is this idea that the beneficiaries of these structures,
yes,
operate in a kind of cognitive space where the normative structure is naturalized, so it's invisible to them. Right. And this is kind of the nature of it. And it's why one of the things that makes them so difficult to shift or to even be acknowledged by their beneficiaries is the idea that the power structure automatically naturalizes its own normative content.
Yes.
In a sense. So, you know, the oppressor can always just be like, well, these are just the facts. And in the case of Marx, and I mean, commodity fetishism is a deeply mysterious concept. And there's a lot of room for sort of disagreeing, I think, about what he really meant there. Mm-hmm. But certainly, like, one of the ways that I have found quite useful to think about it, and this is the influence of Zizek at the moment, is that the fetishism is not necessarily something that happens in the mind. It's something that happens in the act of exchange, right? And so this is tied in with this idea of real abstraction, which is another one of these deeply mysterious ideas from Marxist thought. And Zizek likes to drive this kind of point home a lot. Let's go with an example. Say you've got like, I just find this like some of Marx's own examples, because he's like operating in the sort of industrial world where people really are just like making planks of wood and stuff. Some of his examples are really obscure, but I think they become a lot more clear when you start thinking about social or symbolic goods. So if you imagine something like a wedding ring is like one of the very few items of exchange in our society which doesn't have a kind of commodity structure to it. It's and the reason we know this is because you can't wear someone else's wedding ring. If you do, it's just a ring. The thing that makes it a wedding ring is the fact that its value was symbolically sealed by a kind of social ritual which indexes it to those particular people in that relationship. So you can't buy it. You can't trade it on a market. And this ties in a little bit with that point about discontinuities in value hierarchies. That is a value represented in that wedding ring which cannot be represented in a pricing system, precisely because it's indexed to particularity. But what we could do is we could adopt a new social practice where we treat the ring as if it has some other property, which is just called marriageness. And then we could pretend that the ring itself contains that symbolic value, and then we could trade it. And the way I think about commodity fetishism in Marx's sense is that he's kind of saying that something like that is what we're always doing. So when we talk about the life world of labor, what we are talking about is their actual particular context in which they do stuff, in which they live. But what's happening now is their labor, they're going to the factory, they're working on someone else's project, exchanging that for money, this universal medium, at which point the labor is represented within this pricing mechanism. And then they use that to buy something else, which someone else has made in a different factory. And what's being lost in this process is the index to the particularity. In a way, what this process does is it allows you to take advantage of like huge economies of scale. In the end, they're probably going to end up with like much better furniture or whatever, but all of that furniture is going to be weirdly abstracted from its social context. And in the sense that they didn't make it, right? It's not like, I find this point is almost so simple, it's difficult to make. And this is one of the genius of Marx, I think. So the point about this is it's our actual practices of exchange through this universal medium of money, which create this fetishistic structure where social relations, like, for example, the marriage, are treated as if they are properties of things. Because this facilitates market exchange in a universal medium, it's the thing that needs to happen before things can be exchanged. And that's kind of interesting. And it can kind of happen in a way that's completely disjoint from what we believe about the things. In a way, we can believe that, you know, that particular like packet of chips is the one for me, like, you know, that particular one I really care about. But the moment I then go and pay for it, I have quite literally in my act exchanged it in a universal medium. And I can go away happily believing that it's really important that I have that one, or, you know, that particular piece of clothing is like just really important. But the system of exchange we're participating in is constantly representing our values in this universal medium. And that's happening outside of our mind. It happens in our actions. And this is the point that Zizek loves to drive home. And I think it's a really good point.
That was probably the most clear, articulate explication of the first two chapters of Das Kapital I've ever heard.
those two chapters, I think, are one of the most mysterious pieces of text in the history of Western thought. And I love arguments like that. You know, there's like, you have the Kant's transcendental deduction in the Critique of Pure Reason, and then there's the dialectics of recognition in the Phenomenology of Spirit. But that one by Marx, I think, is possibly the weirdest of all of them.
I mean, reading it several times, it's, for me, and maybe this is a product of my false consciousness via capitalist system, it's very unintuitive. Like, I was like, this is such a strange way of thinking about all of these things, you know, and thinking about the kind of objectified abstraction of labor away from its kind of parochial eccentricities and particularities. I can see this being a really salient critique, moving from kind of medieval guild society, where there is a lot of local, you know, tailoring, literally, to this kind of universalized capitalist system that inevitably leads to a kind of McDonaldization of society, right? So everything is abstracted into the universal via money. But as you said, that has a competitive advantage because it scales much harder. But the result of that is you have a dehumanization of the personal in that, and a complete running roughshod over the labor dynamics and relations that went into producing those goods.
Yeah. So the interesting question for me is how to unpack the second half of that in some way that makes it so explicit that we can really have a grasp on what's going on. And this is where the decision theory aspect comes in for me. And this point about being able to communicate discontinuities in your value hierarchies. That's the thing that markets don't allow us to do.
I'm going all over the place here because I'm getting into the kind of my philosophical gears are warming up and the associations are firing off. But going back to the kind of natural law argument, which I found to be really compelling, because as someone who's always leaned as a kind of, you know, left-leaning atheist materialist type intuitively, I was always looking for kind of a deeper meaning or significance or even utility to the natural law paradigm. And one thing I've been saying on this podcast, kind of as a heuristic I've been playing with in terms of exploring the left-right polarity, is that the left has a compulsion to epistemologize and contextualize, right? That's kind of the critical theory tradition of turning false ontological notions that have been reified by the dominant power structure and problematizing them via kind of a critical interrogation that epistemologizes them. It's like, oh, your perception of reality is actually a product, is actually an instantiation of false consciousness. So you can deconstruct that and see things in a different way, right? The right's tendency is to reroute into ontology. It's a compulsion to ontologize as a kind of counterweight to the leftist tendency to epistemologize or contextualize. And so there are different ideological types or even thought systems that the right tends to gravitate towards that might satiate that ontologizing impulse. For example, what does, you know, traditional religious, you know, Catholic natural law theory have anything to do with evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology? you would think that they're diametrically opposed because you have the whole kind of evolution debate. You got the Richard Dawkins on one side and you got the traditional preacher on the other side, but they're both kind of encouraging a return to the ontological, grounding into something real as a kind of counterweight to this kind of postmodern rampant deconstructionism. So it's kind of like saying, hey, let's root into something real, like biology and biological realities and differences between men and women or whatever, right? Or more controversially between different groups of people, or let's root into this, into a real kind of invisible moral structure that's built into the cosmos, right? So we're not arbitrarily creating norms and arbitrarily creating, moral guardrails and so forth, but those are intrinsic part of the cosmos that you can attune yourself to and live in this kind of real structure, right? So you're merging together ontology and ethics in that way. And that has a very powerful social function that you articulated. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that frame.
Yes, I think I think you're quite right that within the sort of, I guess what would sometimes be called like liberal humanism or the sort of scientific rationalism of the kind of view that someone like Richard Dawkins represents, in some way has a kind of mirror image of this more conservative tradition, which it presents itself as being the kind of anathema of, in the sense that it has to argue essentially that moral values can be grounded in some kind of factual causal process, whether that's an evolutionary process or something else. And the details of how that are going to work is kind of difficult to see how that possibly can work. You know, you have this concept of the naturalistic fallacy or the Humean notion that, you know, there's no valid inference from descriptive premises to prescriptive conclusions. So someone in Richard Dawkins' position or a moral naturalist has to somehow argue that that's wrong, that somehow some description of how things are is going to give you, is going to allow you to draw some conclusions about how things should be or how people should act. And I personally think that's a hopeless task. I probably would see myself much more aligned with a kind of more postmodern form of materialism, which thinks like, so then the natural norms just have to go. And moreover, I would argue ultimately that norms can't possibly, or moral values can't possibly play the function they do, which is to be binding, to coordinate actions, if they are reducible to natural facts. It is almost the fact that they are produced by us which allows them to function as binding on our action. My sort of an idea that I've been toying with but haven't really developed so much is the notion that morality kind of is a solution to collective action problems. Essentially, it's a social technology which allows us to stage ourselves as subjects in discursive context to each other as not rationally self-interested. Essentially, it automatically constructs the universal perspective. That's kind of the nature of moral discourse and the moral ought. And I think Kant in particular sort of laid the groundwork, I think, for this kind of thought by the significance he attaches to the categorical imperative. And I think Kant is taught really, really badly in ethics classes in particular, where he's sort of represented as just the rules guy. You know, he's just a deontologist. He says, you know, the right thing to do is whatever the rules are. But I think what this misses is the meta-ethical dimension of Kant's ethical thought, which is essentially existential. For Kant, moral issues are existential problems. To be immoral is in some sense to commit suicide for Kant. And because of this, this allows him to tie morality directly to rationality. It is irrational to be immoral for Kant. And how he gets to this kind of conclusion is one that I think is left quite mysterious in Kant himself, but can be drawn out, I think, and has been by lots of people. And this is essentially the idea that we are not first moral agents, and then we go out and we talk about morals or do moral things. It is the fact that we participate in this particular language game, this particular moral discourse, doing that, participating in that activity is part of what actually constitutes us as rational subjects. And I think once you start understanding Kant in that way, it opens up a whole way of thinking about ethics, which gives us reason to take it seriously, but without having to make the hopeless argument that norms are founded in nature. They're not things created by us. So I think in many ways, Kant opens the door here.
I don't know if we've already gotten to this and I forgot, but kind of Kant's categorical imperative as a kind of alternative to Nash equilibria.
Yes. Yeah, this kind of ties in with the last point a bit. So usually the categorical imperative, so you should act in only such a way that you can will it as a universal law, right? So this is normally presented as an answer to the question, you know, what's the right thing to do in the most general terms? I think a better way of thinking about it is as representing our best intuition about how the moral ought is used in practice. It describes the rule of that language game. This is what we're doing when we engage in moral discourse. We are reasoning from the universal perspective. That is it. That's just what morality is. It is practical reasoning from the universal perspective. And then when you ask kind of like, why do we do that? I think the answer is essentially that we don't have to, we're not constrained by Nash equilibria, essentially, because.
Maybe you can explain really quickly for the audience who don't know what a Nash equilibrium is.
So a Nash equilibrium is a game theoretic concept, which is when you have a group of rationally self-interested actors in a kind of interactive decision scenario, a Nash equilibrium is just a stable configuration of the decisions that they will make. And stable here means that none of them can unilaterally change their decision without entering a worse situation. It's kind of a complicated situation, a complicated way of explaining it, but it kind of makes sense when you think about examples. So the kind of classic kind of analog of the prisoner's dilemma is the tragedy of the commons, where you have a load of, say, state actors who have to manage a common resource, like fisheries in the North Sea, for example. And it's in everyone's interest to preserve the commons, not take too many fish. Then it will last forever and everyone will be okay. But obviously it's everyone's benefit to just plunder it themselves, because then they'll just get loads. And the question is, how can they cooperate to not plunder the commons? Because the question is, how can you trust other people not to do so? And it's mathematically the same as the prisoner's dilemma. Turns out that rationally speaking, everyone will just plunder the commons. Cooperation is intrinsically difficult. And so in game theoretic terms, a Nash equilibria, we would just say that non-cooperation is the Nash equilibria of this situation. It's the thing that everyone will do if they're rational. And a situation can have more than one Nash equilibria. But when we talk about collective action problems like prisoner's dilemma and the tragedy of commons, these by definition tend to have one. Sorry, what was the thing we were talking about before that?
Yeah, so this is where Kant's categorical imperative comes in as a kind of counterpoint or a counter game or equilibrium point.
Right. So a Nash equilibria is specific to rationally self-interested actors, and game theory as a particular subset of rational decision theory is particularly concerned with a particular kind of rational agent, namely a rationally self-interested agent. So these agents, you know, they have a utility function where they map outcomes to their value hierarchy. They have preferences essentially, and they will act in whichever way they rationally believe will maximize the expected outcomes. Yes, in the context of a group of rationally self-interested actors, the equilibrium strategy is called a Nash equilibrium. Now, if you imagine that people don't reason like that, if they reason using something like the categorical imperative, you have something which in the decision literature, in the decision theory literature, is sometimes called super rationality, which is a term that first came from Douglas Hofstadter, I think. And super rational agent is essentially exactly the same as a game theoretic agent, except they will always reason, they will always assume that other super rational players will play the same strategy as them, and they believe everyone else is super rational. So basically, this is just a like complicated way of saying they treat the categorical imperative as their decision theoretic principle. So the question we can then ask is, what kind of equilibrium strategy do these kind of actors have? This is, we're now not in game theory anymore, we're in a different kind of decision theory. And what happens if we put them in a prisoner's dilemma? The answer is they cooperate, because they're reasoning, they're saying, what would happen if everyone did this, essentially? And then they can reason essentially from the universal perspective, and they can say, oh, well, that'll create a situation where everyone defects and everyone loses out. This kind of gives a bit of a sort of technical substance to the point I was making earlier, that morality is a kind of technology for avoiding prisoner's dilemmas, I think. If we accept that the categorical imperative represents our best intuition about how the moral ought is used, then we can say that, well, the whole point of this, the reason we do this, is because it allows us to avoid these situations. These multipolar traps, essentially. It's a social technology for avoiding multipolar traps. Now, a lot of people will find that a bit reductive and materialistic. It's kind of an anti-realist position on morality, but I think it's justified on the basis that, it, unlike a lot of anti-realist positions, which sort of can end up sounding quite nihilistic, I think this gives us a real reason to be invested in moral discourse. So yeah, that's the kind of line of thought that I've been sort of chewing out a little bit recently, but sort of in the beginning phases of developing.
Yeah, that's great. That's really interesting as a thought experiment. I guess, of course, where it becomes tricky in real life is that if you had 10 prisoners in the prisoner's dilemma, and 9 out of 10 of them were super rational, but one of them was a regular rational, that would cause the defection chain and spiral down. Everyone would have to change their strategy to not get screwed over, right?
Absolutely. And I think the really interesting thing about this is this kind of question gets kind of missed by traditional game theory, because the way the whole thing is set up is, okay, we're just studying the theory of rationally self-interested actors. And the conversations, the kind of the controversies that have emerged over the use of game theory by neoclassical economics are kind of framed in a way which is like, oh, you know, they're treating humans like rationally self-interested actors, when actually in many situations we're not. And then left-wing critics are like, no, we're not rationally self-interested actors, we're actually irrational actors or something. And then economists are like, well, you behave as if you are a lot of the time, so who cares? And the point here is actually that we're not anything in particular, I don't think. Like, I don't think it makes sense to ask that question, because of course, as you're kind of pointing out with that example, is we have to first make a decision about what kind of agent we are. And to do that, we have to look at what other people are doing. So there's like a coordination problem that lies behind the second one, which is working out whether to participate in a form of group reasoning or whether to act. I'm arguing that morality is a social technology which allows us to solve that coordination problem, because it kind of, to even participate in this discourse, it becomes a kind of, it's just a prerequisite of talking like that, that you are automatically reasoning like a super rational agent. And we can think of an example that works the other way, that automatically makes us reason as rationally self-interested agents. And I think a good example, one that I quite like, is the social institution that we call professionalism. When you're like in a company, you're sort of expected to do things like negotiate about your pay, and there's like etiquette surrounding this. You're supposed to do it behind closed doors, blah, blah, you know, you don't talk too much to your colleagues, and you can tell how professional the environment you're in is based on how much people ignore these kind of norms. If we think about what's really going on here, we're kind of, that whole sort of social institution is a way of kind of coordinating on a self-interested decision procedure. It ensures that in those contexts we can game theoretic rules apply, which, you know, is the whole logic of the market, that that's kind of conceived to be good because it allows you to take advantage of all those economies of scale, price signaling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's a good thing. That's a social technology. And some people actually have identified the kind of development of modern professionalism as one of the key social technologies for advancing capitalism in its kind of early modern stage. So yes, so this is a kind of different way of thinking about designing coordination technologies. And at this point, we're starting to touch on what I'm calling social coordination. These are not about economic coordination. Economic coordination assumes you are already doing game theoretic reasoning, whereas this is about the thing that happens one step back from that. And it's more difficult to reason about because you can't help yourself to a load of mathematical assumptions, essentially, because those are exactly what you're trying to establish. But yes, I think it's a kind of interesting way, I think, of translating a lot of the kind of ideas that people like Lacan in particular were thinking about and express in very, very confusing elliptical ways. I think these kind of decision theoretic problems actually begin to hone in on what kind of thing he's getting at. So I see a lot of what I'm preoccupied with now is kind of attempting to translate some of that very insightful but very obscure French thinking into these kind of terms.
I think we can end it there if that's where the progression has led us, and that's where we stand now that we're looking around for maybe more concrete applications. I mean, we could gesture toward what that might look like, or we can just leave it open-ended.
I think let's leave it open-ended for now.
Great. Okay, cool. Yeah, that was all of my favorite parts of your work just laid out really nicely. So I hope people listening go and read stuff. Divine Curation is your blog, yeah?
Yep. Yeah, thank you. That was really great. The time has flown by. I just looked at the clock and was shocked.
I'm hungry.
Thank you very much for the discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.